And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHL with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Next weekend, Harnett County, as we record this, at least the next weekend, Harnett County celebrates its native son, Paul Green, with a Paul Green Festival. Well, what does that have to do with Chapel Hill? We should be celebrating with them because Paul Green is a man who left his mark all over this town. Some people knew him and remember him. Many of us have only heard about him. So we've asked the man who probably knows the most about Paul Green in Chapel Hill, Lawrence Avery, who has edited a volume of pieces about Paul Green, of Paul Green Reader, and also A Southern Life, which are the letters of Paul Green, and done lots more with Paul Green and lots more in this community to make it a richer and better place. And Dr. Avery, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Well, a lot of times you can't say Paul Green's name without putting your name in there with him. You're sort of the world's leading expert on Paul Green. How did all that get started?
Well, I got acquainted with him personally when I was working on another book about a friend of his, another playwright, Maxwell Anderson, and I interviewed Paul at his house. He wanted to talk about Anderson, and we had a good time talking about the theater in the 20s and
this
the 30s.
This would have been
in the 1970s. And then when I got through with the book on Maxwell Anderson, I started looking through Paul Green's papers, some of which were already in the Southern Historical Collection. And I discovered that he'd had a much more interesting life than Maxwell Anderson.
Oh, come on.
No.
What do you mean?
Well, Anderson was a recluse almost and he wasn't outgoing. He didn't like dealing with people, whereas Paul was just the opposite of that. He was outgoing. He had opinions on everything, and he loved writing letters because that was just another way to deal with people. He wrote letters as if they were conversational pieces, and he kept all of his letters, and he kept
copies of all of them.
Copies.
Did he type them or write them? I'm sorry.
Very early, he became an accomplished typist, but he understood in the 1920s, say, that people still appreciated getting handwritten letters more than typed. There was something formal and cold and distant about typed letters. And so I've run across any number of instances where he typed the first draft of a letter, and then he would sit down and copy it by hand and send off the handwritten copy.
But he would then have the typewritten copy.
Then he'd have the typewritten.
And for you to see years later.
That's right. And his letters and his diaries and a few other kinds of papers really unfolded the life story. So I went back to him in the late 70s, the early 80s, and we started talking about doing the edition of his letters, which came out as A Southern Life. And he...
You all were partners in working. I mean, he was kind of looking over your shoulder as you were doing this.
Well, we had a very good working relationship. He didn't look over my shoulder in the sense that he second guessed anything, but he said, "Come on out to my house. I've got a lot of room out here, and I'll just give you a room to work in." And this was before all of his papers had gone to the Southern Historical. So many of the papers that I had to look at, letters and drafts of plays and diaries and so forth, were still at his house at Windy Oaks. And
people in Chapel Hill, we know about the Green subdivisions. Where does Windy Oaks fit in modern-day Chapel Hill?
Well, Green Wood, to which you referred to, the Greens lived there from 1935 to 1965. That was an old 200-acre farm outside Chapel Hill. And Green made his first significant money writing motion picture scripts in Hollywood starting in 1932. And with the money he made writing motion picture scripts, he came back to Chapel Hill and bought that old farm out there, and then built his house, and he and his family were just out there alone with the owls, and then just before the Second World War, he began selling off housing sites, home sites in Greenwood, and the war stymied that, the Second World War, but then from the late 40s on, he sold lot after lot until it became a real community, and now it's a substantial community in Chapel Hill. But by the mid-1960s, it had gotten too crowded for him.
He was like Daniel Boone. He developed the property, and then it was too much.
So he and his wife bought an old farm out on Old Lystra Road, which is halfway from between Chapel Hill and Chatham County. I guess that's the way to put it. And they moved.
Like, it's on the way to the governor's. If I got it right, where?
Mount Carmel Church Road goes down off of 50 after 15501. Mount Carmel Church Road goes down to the governor's club, but shortly after you leave 15501 on Mount Carmel, you take a right, and that's Old Lystra Road, and it doesn't itself go to the governor's club. It twists down into Chatham County. And so they lived out there in this big, rambling farmhouse, the two of them. And so he did have plenty of room.
So he gave you one of them to help.
He gave me it as a study. And if I ran into questions, I would just go and ask him, what were you doing here, or what was the background? And I'd get out there frequently and have a stack of letters or diaries on his desk with a note from him saying, you may find this of interest, because it was related to something we'd been talking about.
I see this partnership working, because you're over there. This is what I need, is a young man to come organize my paper. And then along the way, he finds other things that might not have been in one stack and brings it to you. And
says, yeah, I jogged his memory about a lot of things because of the questions that would come up. And so they were, in that sense, he couldn't have been more cooperative. And he told me one time, I don't want you covering anything up. I didn't do anything terribly bad, but those are my steps, and I don't want any of my steps covered up. And his wife wasn't so sure that we oughtn't to cover up some of the steps.
Give us an example of one of those little sins that he was enthusiastic about not covering up.
Well, we were sitting around the table when I got out there. If I got out there in the morning, they would be sitting around the table drinking their last cup of coffee, and I'd frequently have one. And he got up one morning and looked out the window and said, well, you can look at anything, except I don't think you ought to look at our love letters, the letters Elizabeth and I exchanged. And she nodded her head, and I said, I couldn't say, no, I'm going to look at those letters.
That's what I most want to look at.
Yeah, but I said, okay, if you will. Elizabeth said, nobody is interested in our love letter, our correspondence before we were married. And you're right, it did pique my curiosity. What did they talk about in those letters? I went on. I had thousands of other letters to do, so I didn't have time to fret much about missing those love letters. But then I got out 6 weeks, maybe longer than that. I got out there one morning, and here was a stack of letters that had come from Elizabeth's files. And Paul told me, a little sheepishly, that he had just decided, he felt that was part of their record, his record, and those letters ought to be involved in the story of his life. The addition of his letters was turning out to be the best I say biography of Green.
Or his autobiography in the sense that these were his words.
These were his words, and I tried to annotate them in such a full way that you could always see the context of his experience. And so, you know, I was, I won't say afraid, but I was a little... on edge about looking into these letters. How erotic are they going to be? What did they talk about? And when I got into them, there wasn't anything erotic at all about them. It was just Paul's, he'd come back from the First World War with what we now call post-traumatic experience. I mean, he wasn't incapacitated, but he had nightmares and all kinds of problems of for a few years, emotional problems. And what those letters really revealed was his bearing his soul to somebody who really was a soulmate, and her sort of wise, restrained response. And those are some of the loveliest, excuse me, those are some of the loveliest letters, it turns out, in the edition of the letters. So that's the working relationship we had.
Well, we're visited with Professor Lawrence Avery about one of Chapel Hill's most famous citizens, Paul Green. Dr. Avery and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with a retired Professor Lawrence Avery, retired sort of, but he's a mighty busy retired person, and we're talking about an important person in his life, Paul Green, who's an important person in the lives of every one of us who lives in Chapel Hill, because Paul Green's name and memory is surrounds us. We've been talking a little bit about your project of assembling, editing the editors of Paul Green. As a part of that, did he start writing letters at an early age when he was growing up in Harnett County? Did he save them? Talk about them in his letters?
No, the earliest letter, he didn't leave home until he was, he traveled a time or two to Raleigh, but that was a big trip until he was 21 years old. And then he left home, in a sense, for the first time, and in 1916. And the earliest letter I found was 1916, just after he'd gotten to Chapel Hill as a 21-year-old freshman at the university, living in Smith Hall. Many people will know where Smith Hall is, but back then it was a dorm, and he wrote a letter to his older sister asking her to send him some clothes that he'd forgotten to bring. And that's the earliest letter I found. And he probably had written letters before then, but I doubt if he'd written a whole lot.
You've just gotten conscious of holding on to copies of them.
Yeah, well, his older sister, Mary, what turned out to be the family historian, she had that instinct anyhow. Their mother had died when she was in her late high school years, and she gave up school. This was, you know, before the 1920s. This was 1910, 1911, 1912. She dropped out of school, and she became the mother of the smaller children. So she always had a sense of the family, and she was the family historian, and she kept all the letters.
All the letters she got from her siblings. Well, tell us about, we're doing this in the context of this upcoming festival, Paul Green Festival down in Harnett County. What was life like for him growing up as a rural county? Harnett County's to the east of, right to the east of Raleigh, and I guess.
And south.
Southeast, long I-95 before you turn right to go to Fayetteville or left to go up to Richmond.
Well, it was a farm, and it was his father owned the farm, so he was a landowner, which was in that era was a sharp distinction. People who owned the farm and tenant farmers, people who worked for the landowners. And his father was a landowner and had black tenant farmers and white tenant farmers. So he was, Green grew up as a boy, cheek to jowl with black kids and white kids. Many of the tenants moved almost every year, and that turns out to be the basis for the experience of one of Green's most powerful stories called This Body, the Earth, which I hope we have a chance to talk about in a little while. But he plowed, picked cotton, cropped tobacco. And though back then, cotton was the main financial crop. Tobacco that grew, but cotton was the main thing. And he had an exceptional mother. She was a wonderful musician, and she wrote poems and articles for the local paper and the religious press in that area, and she made sure the family went to church. And her father was a upstanding member of the community, somebody looked up to. But I imagine it was just a pretty typical farm life for somebody who was fortunate enough to be on a farm owned by his family. Paul was the second child and the older son. And then he had a younger brother, and then he had three younger sisters. So it was a fairly large family.
But this image of him behind a plow with a book of poetry or a notebook writing—is that just a myth?
Well, he said several times, "I used to plow with a book of poetry or a book of this, that, or the other on the handlebars, because the mule knew the way to the end of the row." I don't know how.
That would be illegal. That's like texting or talking on the cell phone in Chapel Hill. Yeah. It sounds like it might get your mind off what you were really doing.
Really, one thing I'm pretty sure he did is to spend his evenings reading, and he liked to memorize poems, and he knew lots of poetry by heart. And it's much more plausible to me, and in fact he has said this, that he would spend the time while he was working in the fields, plowing or whatever he was doing, scattering manure or whatever, reciting the poems that he memorized the previous night just to fix them in his memory. And that's more plausible to me than reading the book while you're plowing.
Well, let's get him to Chapel Hill as a student. And you mentioned about 1916.
Yeah.
Now, talk to us a little bit about what Chapel Hill was like and who he encountered that made a difference, and then how that those important factors in his life were modified by his participation in the First World War.
Well, he came up as a freshman, as I said, in 1916. W.O. Campbell, do I have his first name? The Buies Creek Baptist minister who started Campbell University sort of got his eye on Paul as a promising student and got him a fellowship to Wake Forest University. Campbell was a Baptist preacher, and he had a low opinion, or he thought Chapel Hill was a dangerous place. Somebody would go there and lose their religious faith. That's what he told Paul. And so he got Paul a fellowship that would cover his tuition to Wake Forest. But Paul had made up his mind. He was adventuresome, and he wanted to go to this wild place, Chapel Hill, just because it was a place where people didn't conform in their thought to the way everybody around his home place thought. I mean, it was a challenge. He looked on it as a opportunity to grow, to test himself. So he didn't take the fellowship to Wake Forest. He instead worked 3 years teaching school.
He had
out of high school. He taught school and was the principal of the school for 3 years, making $50 a month. Since he lived at home, he was able to save a little money. And so he got up to Chapel Hill in 1916. And Horace Williams was the atheist who alarmed Campbell and everybody else. And Horace Williams was the person Green gravitated to at first, and he wound up being majoring in philosophy. And once he got a master's degree, Horace Williams hired him back as the second member of the philosophy department. But that's getting ahead of the story.
Was Thomas Wolfe passing through Chapel Hill about this time?
Not yet. In the spring of 1917, Woodrow Wilson took us into the First World War. And Green and as far as I can tell, a whole lot of the rest of the campus was stirred by Wilson's message, make the world free for democracy. And a whole bunch of undergraduate men, and most of them were men back then. Women had been admitted as students, but there were very few. Many of them volunteered, and Green among them, in the spring of 1917. So he finished his first year. Then he went into the Army, to the Engineering Corps. And after 8 or 10 months of training, mostly in South Carolina, they shipped out for France. And Green's unit got to France in the last months of the war, but he saw some terrible fighting. And in the Engineering Corps, he was digging trenches and laying communication lines and turning up skulls and bones and so forth where they would dig. And it was not a pleasant experience, though he wasn't in the infantry. He wasn't out doing the shooting itself. But he had such a good practical head on him that he was put in charge of all the supplies and the logistics for his company. And after the war, he was promoted to a first lieutenant and was kept in France, in Paris, for 6-8 months, tidying up, paying all the bills, collecting all from the French government, sorting out the materials and getting it routed home, getting the troops routed home. And he was very good at that kind of thing. He had a sharp analytical mind, and he enjoyed the time after the war in Paris. He played baseball on an army team and visited museums and courted a French lady, and just had a wonderful time getting acquainted with the big wide world that he'd heard about but had never dreamed of, really, down in Harnett County. So he came back from the war in the late summer of 1919. A very different person from this perspective now of somebody who'd lived in Paris for almost a year and was acquainted with the museums and the big world. And Woodrow Wilson was one of his heroes, and he was over there in December of 1918 when Wilson made the first trip of an American president outside the continental United States. Wilson came over to try to organize the League of Nations and had a wonderful parade down the Champs-Élysées, and Green was in the crowd cheering for Wilson. Green would buy copies of the various versions of the League of Nations as it developed and keep up with what was happening in the peace conference and what was happening in the development of the League of Nations. It just fascinated him no end. That and going to see Charlie Chaplin motion pictures, which the Army showed to the soldiers to entertain them, were the highlights of his stay.
So he came back to Chapel Hill, not a Harnett County farm boy, but a cosmopolitan.
You're right.
Toughened, yeah. Older and man.
That's right.
Well, we need to take a break, but we'll come back and talk some more about Paul Green, all this in the context of celebrating one of Chapel Hill's most famous citizens and the upcoming Paul Green Festival down in Harnett County, where Green grew up. Professor Avery, and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Professor Lawrence Avery. We're talking about Paul Green. Professor Avery spent a large part of his life working on Paul Green matters. And down in Harnett County, where Paul Green grew up, they're celebrating the Paul Green Festival, and we're celebrating him here in Chapel Hill. And in part, before we took a break, you were about to talk about how what happened when Paul Green came back from the First World War and the aftermath of the war to Chapel Hill as an older person. And I'd asked you earlier, did he ever run into Paul Thomas Wolfe? And you said, well, I have to tell you. Now you're ready to tell me.
Yeah, okay, yeah. A lot had changed in that two school years that Green had missed. The most significant change was that Frederick Koch had joined the faculty. Koch wasn't here before that. He came in 1918. So when Green got back in the fall of 1919, Frederick Koch had his playmakers. Frederick Koch was an English professor, I have to say, since I come from the English department. Koch had his playmakers group in high gear. Thomas Wolfe was here as a freshman, and also Elizabeth Lay. There were many more women in the undergraduate program after the war than there had been before, and Elizabeth Lay was one of the stars, really. In the undergraduate body, and also in Koch's playwriting group, his folk plays. And that first year that Green was back, 1919, Koch got up his first program of produced play, his first productions of playmakers' plays, and the very first play done was one by Elizabeth Lay called When Witches Ride. These were all supposed to be folk plays, and her instinct was for the legends, and so a lot of supernatural things came up in her plays. The second play done was by that evening. They did them, since they were one-act plays, they did them the same evening. The second play was by Thomas Wolfe, and his play was a sort of hokey play made up from a newspaper article about an outlaw who was tracked down in the Missouri mountains, even though he said it in the North Carolina mountains. But Green had never thought of writing plays, but he later said, once you were on the campus and in Koch's under Koch's influence, everybody decided that he or she was a playwright. That's what they wanted to do. And so Koch generated all kinds of enthusiasm about the arts in general and the theater in particular. And eventually he started a North Carolina play festival that for the 1930s and the 1940s seems to me to have attracted statewide attention, sort of like the ACC basketball tournament. High schools from all over the state.
Everybody would come and put on a play competition.
Would come on, that's right.
And Koch would, and his allies or his friends would be the judges. Thomas Wolfe, as we remember, tried to be a playwright, didn't work, became a novelist. Now, Paul Green tried to be a playwright and found success.
He did work, that's right.
How did that happen?
Well, I mentioned that Elizabeth was inclined towards the supernatural elements of folklore. Paul himself wasn't. He gravitated toward the down and outs of society. He had a social conscience that manifested itself in all areas of his life, but his playwriting and his writing, certainly. So he wrote about tenant farmers and convicts and the Lumbee Indians, the people who were on the outside or on the verge or on the bottom rungs of society. And their suffering, their struggles and tribulations were the things that galvanized his imagination. And so there very little supernatural goes on in his plays. But he was very prolific. He turned out to write probably more plays probably than most anybody else in that Playmakers program. And then, of course, he was more mature. He wasn't 19. He was now in his mid-20s, and he'd had this...
Had a life experience.
The experience that the other people who had never left home didn't have. So he matured very quickly as a playwright.
Well, I wish we... I want to jump ahead, because the... you know, a playwright who's been dead and gone for many years and whose plays are still being produced, it's rare.
Yeah.
And we know Paul Green, I guess, or some of us know him best as the dramatist for The Lost Colony.
The Lost Colony.
Which, a play which has been running...
Since 1937.
Now, it's pushing towards 100 years, really. Yeah. I mean, with 75 years. An amazing... You know, unbelievable achievement. So, will you talk for just a minute about how that happened? Can you do that without? Can you break away from
the Lost Colony?
Yeah,
sure. The state made a movie of the Lost Colony back in the 1920s and 1921 it was. And Green was so fascinated with the story of the Lost Colony.
It had to be a silent movie.
It was a silent movie, and there's still copies of it in the archives here. You can go see
wow.
it. But Green made a trip, which was a horrendous trip, out to Manteo. Back then it took you 3 days to get out there because you... he went out there to watch the filming a little bit, and he wrote to Elizabeth. They weren't married yet, but he wrote to Elizabeth about that experience—a 9 or 10 page letter—and he drew her maps of the old fort and everything. So he was fascinated by that kind of thing, and then in the mid 1930s, people with some means. A state legislator and a newspaper editor and so forth. People out there had always been resentful of the story of American history, which had always been written from a New England point of view. So you had the story of Plymouth and Boston, and maybe Connecticut got in there a little bit. And the rest of the story of early America was sort of a footnote. And they knew... quite well that the first attempted colony was right here on Roanoke Island, and they wanted to do something to boost the national consciousness of that. And what they thought of doing was holding a beauty pageant, but they said we need to do a little more than that. And here we've got over in Chapel Hill, Paul Green was back on the faculty by 1935. They said, you know, he's won a Pulitzer Prize for a play. He's written motion pictures for Will Rogers and all these other people. So he's extremely well known. Let's get him to write us a historical pageant. And so they came over and talked with Green about doing it. And he was eager to do it. He was eager to be involved in it because of his fascination.
We know what an outdoor pageant is today, but it wasn't... I mean, no. It wasn't an established genre, or was it, at that point?
Well, there were historical pageants, but Green didn't write him a pageant. He wrote a play. A pageant follows the chronology of history, and the characters aren't developed. They just step out of context and say whatever they said, and then they move back. And he wanted to write a play that had a plot and a theme and developed characters. So... the idea of a beauty pageant very quickly went by the boards, and they thought, well, we'll do it this one year in 1937, which will celebrate the, 1587 to 1937. I think it was 250 or 350th anniversary of that settlement. We'll do it that one year. So they hacked up a little contract, and it's in the book of letters because Green wrote it as a letter. And he made them a play that had a theme. And the theme combined his experience in Harnett County and his sympathy for the underdogs and his experience in Europe, where he had really been ticked off by the hierarchical status, especially in the British Army. He could see the stratification in society because he had to deal with the British military. And it just burned him up that, you know, some people were better than others. And he didn't think that. So he really made the play, The Lost Colony, which was supposed to celebrate English colonization in this country, an anti-English play. The play takes the stratified society in England, where there's the Queen, and there are the big nobles, Raleigh and the others, and then the lesser nobles, and all the way down to the to what's called the masterless men, that is, the people who have no standing in that society at all. And the plot of the play, the theme of the play, growing out of the plot growing out of the theme, is what happened to this stratified social mentality when people got into the frontier conditions. And what it did, of course, is to strip away the artificial importance. Nobody is better than anybody else intrinsically. You are more useful to society. The more energy you put into the general welfare, the more you contribute. It's a leveling experience.
It's a story, as you describe it, of our American myth of what happens when we get here. Well, we need to take a break. I hate to stop in the middle of this. This is an extraordinary story. We're visiting with Lawrence Avery, who is the man who knows more about Paul Green than anybody else in the world, and he and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I've been visiting with Professor Lawrence Avery, and we've been talking about Paul Green, one of the most famous people who ever lived in Chapel Hill. And we've had this wonderful conversation about the Lost Colony, which is how I know Paul Green best. But I didn't, until you told me about what he was doing with this play, I never understood that. So thank you. But now, we just got a minute or two left, but you've done a whole lot more than just fiddle with Paul Green or play the violin with Paul Green.
Well, I was chair of the English department for a term and found that, some things were quite satisfying about it. It gives you a chance to hire some very good faculty members, and also gave me an opportunity to work with Alan and Musette Morgan to get established what the community now, I think, is pretty well aware of, the Morgan Family Writer-in-Residence program.
This is the most wonderful experience we've had.
It's always a big occasion every year.
How did that happen?
Well, Alan was a graduate from here and had a love for this campus, even though he was in finance. He's a mortgage broker. But he came, our outreach fundraising wing brought him over. He had expressed an interest in doing something, and they put him in touch with me, and we had lunch at the Carolina Inn one day and talked about the various possibilities, and he said, let me give you, what could you do if I gave you $50,000? And I had just been dealing with some other people who wanted to give us an endowment of $50,000, which means since the payout is 5%, we'd have $5,000 to work with. And so I wasn't all that excited when he said, what could I do with $50,000? Because that translated for me to $5,000. And he said, oh, no, I mean, just give it to you $50,000 every year. What could you do with it? So that changed the ballpark a little bit. And in fact, he wound up giving a lot more than that after a few years. So it was one of the best financed programs that has existed on the campus. And we were able to get any writer really we wanted. And we devised a program that would take the writer into our classes, especially with our writing classes in the English department. But then campus-wide, it would involve people. And then there would be programs that were community-wide. So I've been very, very proud of that program and pleased with the way it worked out.
Well, it was a wonderful series, and it's shown by the spirit, which even as the Morgans concluded it. The appreciation expressed to them by the community was genuine and heartfelt, I think. It was a
20 years.
Great set, and we got to look forward to doing something like it, although it's difficult now. The cost of bringing a famous writer, it's a bit more than inflationary. I hear about these great writers charging, just to bring them without expenses and everything else in the $25,000, $30,000, $50,000 a year for a single appearance.
We were lucky with Fugard, the most recent writer, who is from South Africa. But you probably know there's been a kind of upsurge in productions of his plays. And I think he's got two plays in production or in anticipation in New York. So he was going to be in this country. And so everything dovetailed so that we could get him to Chapel Hill. And turned out he was a lovely person. He was so energetic and worked with the students and met people in the community and gave a wonderful talk outlining his life. So that's been a very good thing for the university.
Well, thank you for that. I especially thank you. A very important part of my being in Chapel Hill. As now even more enriching is the experience of living in a place where Paul Green lived because you told me about him.
Thank you,
Dr. Avery. And don't forget the Paul Green Festival coming up shortly down in Harnett County. We'll have some information and links on our webpage, chapelboro.com. And thanks for listening. It's D.G. Martin who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.